joining me on the Senate side, Senator Fred Dyson, Vice Chair, myself, Chair Dennis Egan, and there are other senators that are on the way to, they're on their way down the hall. Chair Wilson.
All right.
Introduce your members.
All right. My members that are present are Representative Feige, Representative Isaacson, Representative Lynn, Representative Gaddis.
We had to postpone this a couple of times. I understand you leave tonight for Washington, D.C. to make the same presentation to a congressional committee. And again, we apologize. Chair Wilson and myself apologize for having to delay this a week because we didn't complete the other issues that we thought we were going to get through in a minute. It didn't happen. Ed, welcome. Ed, the Executive Director of the Alaska Marine Exchange, or the Marine Exchange of Alaska. And welcome, and if you can introduce your presenters.
Yes, sir.
And
thank you for
we look forward to it.
Opportunity for us to tell a story, an organization that exists because of the state legislature, and it's been in existence for 12 years. I'm accompanied here today by my Chief Technical Officer, Bill Benning, who's been with us from day one. He's a prior Coast Guard like myself, and helped join me. This wouldn't happen. His fingerprint on every one of the things I'm talking about today, all throughout Alaska, his fingerprint's on it and very key. But also my mentor, leader, and good friend is Mr. Paul Foos, who's the president of the board of directors, and who, with myself, 12 years ago, or actually 13 years ago, sat down in a bar in Anchorage and kind of crafted out this idea of coming up with the Marine Exchange.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, sure. But that's where Paul would be. But I'd like to represent or
Senator,
acknowledge Senator Hall's French. Senator Transportation, continue.
All right, so I'm going to give you a quick briefing. As several slides go a little easier way of explaining what this maritime safety net is that we've established over the last several years and how, where it's going and how important it is to the safety, efficiency, environmental protection, and even security for that matter for our state of Alaska, which is the most complex, diverse maritime state by far. I served in the Coast Guard for some 30 years. First came up here after sailing on the East Coast for a while, came up here on a Coast Guard cutter in 1973. Have now about 25 years up in Alaska. I've sailed on tankers and container ships and tugboats and fishing vessels and Coast Guard vessels, offshore supply vessels, drilling rigs, platforms throughout Alaska, and always been fascinated with the state and the challenges, but also very concerned with the safety concerns and safety issues. Having been involved in the Exxon Valdez spill for several years and some search and rescue cases, I became somewhat obsessed with the idea if we have a vessel tracking system, the more vessels are, we'll save a lot of lives.
Ed, I'm sorry to interrupt you again, but I'd like to welcome Vice Chair Senator Dyson of the Senate Transportation Committee. Continue. Sorry.
Yes, sir. So Marine Exchange is not maybe a household name, so I'll explain real quickly. Marine Exchange is basically exchange maritime information and go back to the 1800s. They started in places like San Francisco and Baltimore and what have you. So merchants would know when a ship was coming in versus standing on the docks the whole time and waiting for them. When I was in the Coast Guard, whenever I had assignment to board a ship or inspect the vessel or what have you, I would call the Marine Exchange to find out where the vessels were. In fact, when I served as a captain of port for Los Angeles Long Beach, routinely I would call the first call I'd make with the Marine Exchange every day because they had the information that I needed to carry out my business. In fact, over the course of the next couple of years, we developed a partnership with that Marine Exchange. We have a joint, still exists today, a joint Marine Exchange Coast Guard vessel tracking system that was supported by the state of California, the Coast Guard, and the maritime industry. I took that model, got out of the Coast Guard, and said we need to do this in Alaska. The differences are the Marine Exchange in LA has a 25-mile radar, which is totally useless up here in Alaska because of the size of our state. So we're using different technology. We've really pushed the envelope on technology. As you'll see here in a minute, to track vessels to aid maritime safety. As I mentioned beforehand, there's no state more challenging and larger than Alaska. And one of the key things of being effective in maritime safety, having information on location of vessels, validated compliance with operations in off-limited areas and well-protected areas. So that's what this tool does. It's already been involved in saving lives, protecting the environment over the last several years. And I'll show you how that's been applied, what have you. But clearly, this is the most complex state when you think of offshore drilling, exploration, tankers, container ships, passenger vessels. We have it all.
Foreign vessels.
Yes, sir, and foreign vessels. In fact, this picture kind of highlights, I like to refer to it as the I-5, the Pacific I-5, but these ships are sailing from Seattle and going on to the Far East, right through our backyard, right through the Unimac Pass. Thousands of vessels, about 9,000 transits a year, if you really add them all up, going through the Gulf of Alaska, through our waters, and on somewhere else. And obviously, at times, they provide some present some hazards, and they've had some instances that happened in the past, such as the Stellar NIU, which provides a catalyst for having some better safety net than we have today. So we are tracking vessels today through a variety of systems, which I'm going to explain a little further, including satellite tracking, automatic identification systems that are used to state-of-the-art technology. When we look at the different regions of our state...
Ed, I'm sorry, I didn't interrupt you. Representative Isaacson has a question.
Thanks, Captain. I just wanted to ask because one of my, you know, being in the interior, this is all fascinating to me, but
sure.
I had a friend, a vice president of one of the shipping companies, show me an app on it. He uses it on his iPhone or iPad or whatever. Is this now the Maritime Exchange? I'm still trying to put my arms around what you are. And you're basically a physical app, in other words.
Basically, we have the sensor. We have 100 stations. We call them marine safety sites. We have weather stations, automatic identification system receiving stations, and even search and rescue receiving stations that bring in information. And then we can disseminate that. In fact, one of our customers is Lloyd's of London. We also, my iPad, I can show you right now where ferries are or tankers or what have you, or my iPhone, which is obviously turned off at the moment. So it's similar to that. The difference is people who want information, any app you see, if it gets information in Alaska that's real-time, it's coming from us. They have to pay us to pay you to support the system to get the access to that information. So Lloyd's of London pays us.
Okay, Philip. So that app, there's some free ones on iPhone and so
right.
forth. They're not complete as complete as what you provide.
Absolutely, that's correct.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
This is just an example of some of the traffic activity in our state. Cook Inlet, you can see the traffic activity historical. People come to us all information all the time for information on port planning, either for the Port of Anchorage, for the Port of Juneau, for Arctic ports. They say, where are the ships now? What kind of ships? Where do they go? That information is provided by us. We have the best information available on that. So we're looking here, the top left, Cook Inlet, Southeast Alaska, Arctic, the Aleutian Islands. Those are different areas that we're focusing on, but we have coverage throughout the state. Yes?
Sure,
thank you, Mr. Chairman. If you go back to the previous slide, it's amazing to me how much is going through the Arctic already.
It is and isn't. I mean, that's over a period of a year. It's several hundred vessels, probably in the neighborhood of 500. That's quite a bit. You'll see 100,000 transits a year in the L.A., Long Beach area, so it's you kind of benchmark it about other areas, but certainly a lot more than ever existed beforehand, and it's growing every year, and it's larger vessels coming in, for sure. This whole concept has worked because there's shared common commitment on the part of the state, the maritime industry, and the Coast Guard, and some of the things that helped push this along was the wake of Exxon Valdez and a need to be more environmentally conscious, the Arctic Rose tragedy that happened. I was chief of marine safety for Alaska, and Bill was chief of communications, and we said there's got to be a better way than searching a plane 6 hours afterwards and looking for it. We could have better information. Emergence of new technology that here before were not available, and then the cruise ship environmental issues. How do we monitor cruise ships and validate compliance? So all these things kind of came together as a perfect storm that really helped us provide the catalyst and a need. People say, why do you need to know where the vessels are? Now people understood why we needed it. So the issues clear today are ensuring that our oil, land, and mineral development is a success story, that this I-5 thoroughfare does not negatively impact Alaska, that Dixon Inter Canadian trade does not negatively impact our waters, Alaska North Slope crude and LNG can be done safely and shipped to market safely, Kivalina and other mines are safe operations, and cruise ship operation environmentally sound, and supply of goods to Alaska, which was so dependent on this, are safe and efficient.
Yeah, I hate to interrupt you again, but we're joined now by Senator Fairclough. Welcome.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Continue.
Sir. So how this is funded right now, which is we're approaching about $2.5 million a year. It's funded by the state, the Coast Guard, and the Maritime Ministry. Presently, we're in the governor's budget, and we have been for several years now, $600,000 a year in the capital budget, and previously the legislature has put it in your budget for that matter, and of course you've approved it in the past, last several budget cycles. That's been used to build our system, which is about, that represents about 30% of our overall costs. Now, the Coast Guard also pays in a system to access it, that's operational costs, and the maritime industry, Shell, Trident Seafoods, tug companies, Western Alaska Marine Lines, Crowley, all those are members, but also contributing to support the system. So it's basically those who participate pay into it. It is a good nexus as far as the cruise ship head tax, because the language and the legislation does specifically allow those funds, or actually restrict the use of those funds, to maritime related. And the one provision that is directly hits the nail on the head or applicable to the Marine Exchange is that funding that enhances the safety and efficiency of interstate and foreign commerce. So clearly that's how we are used and how it's applied, so it's a good fit. We're also tied to the rest of the country, and I won't go too far in that, but we are the leader of the pack of all the Marine Exchanges around the country. In fact, all the information in our office, we can see vessels from Maine, Gulf of Mexico, L.A., San Francisco, Seattle, and Alaska. Benny actually at one point sent me Houston and with a one-way ticket to return out of Boston. He basically was like Johnny Appleseed with a pickup truck and installing AIS sites on the East Coast, as I called them, and said, next place is a friend of mine in Mobile, and install it there. So we built a national system. All that information comes into the Marine Exchange of Alaska. We are the nerve center. We're the technical lead on this program, and then we disseminate it to the Coast Guard, Lloyd's of London, and other parties and maritime industries from Juneau. Yes, sir.
Ed, where's this located?
Right on the waterfront above the Juneau Electronics Building.
Thank you.
Sir. In Juneau. The customers and clients cover the whole range, from container ships, tankers, cruise ships, ports and terminals, ferries, Coast Guard, the whole maritime industry basically is tied into it, and we monitor that community. The founding members were the ports, the pilot associations, the shipping companies, seafood industry, and tanker industry, and container lines and tug lines. So, and that continues to be our board, which again, as mentioned before, and it's headed by Paul Foose, but this is the board composition. So we do reach out and touch every segment of the maritime industry to help us guide and ensure that we're meeting our mission statement and being effective and cost-effective and good stewards of the money that's provided both by the industry, the Coast Guard, and, of course, the state. Our programs are maritime pride and education. We're trying to encourage more youth to pursue maritime careers because there's a shortage of crew members over the period of time. We actually produce and print out charts, real-time charts, accurate information, accurate from 94, because we're tied directly to the NOAA database. That's a service so that vessels come in can have accurate ports with charts. It helps ensure they can safely operate in our waters. We do a lot of compliance work, which helps us pay for some of our costs, our overhead costs. It also gets us traveling throughout the state. So we fly out to ADAC to do, next week I'll be in Dutch Harbor. I'm doing some consulting work, help with the Harbor Safety Committee and some safety issues they have there. At the same time, we will be installing some new upgraded vessel tracking sites to improve the range in that particular area. So that's how we kind of double up and economize by doing various consulting work, but at the same time installing vessel tracking systems and then giving the port access to that system. And of course, vessel tracking and database, the key component of our system. Safety net, Mighty Track vessel provides a safety net. It helps us assess the risk of various trade routes, and the Coast Guard is using that now for the port route access study of the Bering Strait, using our information for that. In fact, their direct feed of all our information goes into the Coast Guard. And I was getting frantic calls from the Admiral saying, I need the app or your installing it from my iPhone because I don't want to be in the command center the whole time the color is happening. I want to go home, so I want to go watch it from home on my iPad. So, okay, we can make that happen. Environmental protection, validated compliance, emergency response, improve the efficiency, and fleet management. Those are all the applications. And this body certainly understands that the expectations of the government and the agencies and the Coast Guard and the state is that we don't want anything to go wrong. You know, 99.9% success is what we've had with diving vessels in and out of Prince William Sound, but that's not good enough. 99.9% equates public outrage. We need better than that. So it's a very high-stakes game. Costa Concordia, Exxon Valdez are two examples of ships that were not being monitored, being supervised. Exxon Valdez beyond the Coast Guard's oversight, beyond the last radar, And so the captain decided, I'm going to go out of the channel, avoid the iceberg, and go down below, even though I'm supposed to be on the bridge. Had he been watched, it might have been a different outcome, because the Coast Guard would have called him, and he would never have left the bridge. He'd probably never gone outside the channel without contacting the Coast Guard. Same thing at Costa Concordia. If somebody's watching Costa Concordia, I find it hard to believe they would do that. As I mentioned before, this technological safety net, the only reason why you can pull this off is because of new technology. It's automatic identification system, much akin to what aircraft have. Vessels are required by international treaty and Coast Guard regulation to have these transponders on board the vessel to send out information every couple seconds, course, speed, cargo, destination, dimensions. That's what we're bringing up. We're bringing that information into the system. We also have satellite transponders and other vessels where we don't have good coverage for AIS because of line of sight, VHF range, 100 miles, sometimes 200 mile range. But beyond that, we use other systems. We also have weather environmental sensors. We're adding different capabilities to our remote sites. I'll explain how that's done. We're also working on sending out information over AIS to ships, environmental information, what have you. And most recently, we're working on digital sector calling radios, receipts. If you push the red button on this radio anywhere in the United States except Alaska, the Coast Guard will get a call and it'll tell you the position of the vessel and the name of the vessel. If you push that button in Alaska, it does not work because Congress did not provide enough money to the Coast Guard to build a system in Alaska. Mm-hmm. We're doing that pro bono. We're building the DSC receivers so they go into the Coast Guard offices when you push the red button. This is our next thing that we're undertaking as we speak.
Question?
I'm sorry, yes sir.
Through the chair.
Will that hook into ALMAR system, or is that just dedicated to shipping alone? And the DSC, could you explain a little bit more?
I won't go into the LMR system. It okay, strictly so goes right to the Coast Guard. It goes to the radio and then on to the Coast Guard into our command center.
Okay.
Sure. The Coast Guard could turn around and turn into the LMR if you wanted to.
Gotcha.
Our PACTRAX, the display system, basically is taking information from vessels. They're captured by ashore stations and they're delivered to marine exchange and then disseminated out. As I mentioned beforehand, this is an international requirement, so vessels on international trade sailing through our waters are required to have AIS. The trick now is being able to pick up that information. Coast Guard not get the funding to build the AIS network in Alaska. So we decided if we put this, and this is the same problem I had in LA Long Beach, we did not have a vessel traffic system, and Congress was not providing the money, and being a very impatient captain of the port, I said, well, we're going to find another way of getting this done. Let's get the people who are interested, let's partner, let's put our money in together, and we'll build a vessel traffic system. Same model as what we're doing up here. We're building a system since Congress could not find the money to build a system in Alaska because it's just so incredibly expensive to build it. And such the same was happening to the search and rescue system has not come online here. Well, it hasn't in Lower 48. Similarly, when you look at the studies that have been done, the Arctic Maritime Shipping Assessment or the National Academy of Science Report, every one of them come up and say we need to complete and build an AIS network and make sure we can track vessels. It's a key component in all these reports. So it's just myself thinking this is relevant. It's others think. So this is our network. If you're looking through Alaska, and I apologize there that we're not up in the interior, but we're working on it. And we're actually starting to work our way into rivers. But clearly we have 100 marine safety sites to Alaska from Kaktovik up to Barrow, out to Adak, down to Ketchikan throughout the area. And when you compare that to like 11 nations on the Baltic that have come together to build an AIS network, we really have a bigger system, more complex than 11 countries, and we have 16 people that are operating in marine exchange in Juneau. So it's a fairly cost-effective, streamlined system.
Senator Dyson.
Yes, sir. Yeah.
Yeah. Tell them a little bit about the equipment we smuggled into Canada for the Canadian High Arctic last summer.
Well, through the chair, for clarification, I didn't smuggle anything, but I understood Senator Dyson was I was able to use his services to help me, since we were having a hard time with some of the barriers, and while they wanted to be able to track vessels up there, they had a lot of restrictions on bringing foreign equipment in. But we found someone willing to, at a meeting that was a joint meeting with the Canadians, left one of our systems on his chair, which unfortunately disappeared, and ended up in Tuktoyaktuk, and so we have some creative ways of expanding our network thanks to some of our folks in the legislature. Sure.
Follow up, Senator Dyson.
We're friends in high places. Literally and figuratively. And so we're looking at different areas. We're looking at choke points. There's no one's going to come, no ship's going to come to Alaska that's in compliance with the law and not be picked up by our vessel tracking system. We deliberately focused on making sure we have coverage where the ferries go, we have coverage where the high-risk vessels go, the tankers and faster vessels, and we have focus on all entry points to Alaska. So southeast, eastern Arctic, through Russia, what have you, we have it covered. And how do we do this? Because, you know, Lockheed Martin would take several hundred million dollars to do it. We've used the network of the maritime community to build a system. We're on schools, we're harbor offices, we're on lighthouses, we're pilot stations, tug offices, your harbor and your community in Sitka, but also in Homer and Anchorage and Port McKenzie. We're using our relationship with the maritime industry to say, let's help build a system. And everyone's willing to contribute. And some of these pictures are shown at lighthouses. We're also partnering with the University of Alaska Fairbanks. But this is a way we can leverage resources and get more done with less. And so there's some pictures of some of our sites. It's our vessel that we run around. We put about 3,000 miles a year on this vessel. It's a site that we built down in southeast Alaska, so we looked into Canadian waters. We could never get agreement with, well, I flew down to Canada, met with the Canadians. They loved the idea. Bureaucracy got in the way, so we said, guess what? We're just going to build one right, and we'll look over your side, which is like we do in Russia right now. So this is just building one of our sites, offloading supplies and building solar panels, wind generators, radios, and then picking up vessels with that information. Here's another site down in Cape Decision. We took a sailboat down there, got some friends to come along with us, crew with us, and at the end of the day, we built a system. We partnered with the lighthouse, said, guess what? You got some power now. We just brought power into you. And communications, you can have internet, and we're looking at tankers. In this particular case, it's a vessel 225 miles offshore being picked up by that receiving site at Cape Decision. We've also obviously put a lot of emphasis as recently on the Arctic and building sites. That's Bill Benning actually on top of a building up in Barrow, building one of the sites, and having a good day, I'm sure, of it. But these are some of the late places we're up there in Alaska, up in northern Alaska, excuse me. Which allows us to look into Russian waters, and we're going further and putting one up in Diomede Island here this spring. So how do we apply all this information? Well, we validate cruise ship compliance. We validate compliance with speed limits in Glacier Bay. Shell's compliance with the permit restrictions up in the Arctic. Fiber cables for GCI and ACS, if there's a break in the cable, we can tell them where a ship anchored on it, which happened a couple times, and we can bring them right to the scene so they can effect repairs immediately. Preventing collisions at Kodiak Airport, I'll explain that in a minute. Port planning, risk assessments, vessel support operation security. If we have basically bank teller alarms, if you will, called ship security alert systems that are required to be carried on tankers and ferries and other vessels. Those alarms go in our 24-hour operations center. They go off, and then we contact the security officer and the Coast Guard, what have you. We haven't had any security alerts, but those hidden buttons are on the ships. You have to test them every month. They go off in our office. A big OOG alarm goes off, and we start making phone calls and ensuring the system's working properly. This is akin to, if you look at compliance, this is my analogy is it's like putting one of these little sensors every 100 yards down the road. Except it's actually connected to the police department because all this information we're collecting is going to the Coast Guard and it's going to the state of Alaska. So over time, mariners, if they know they're being monitored, are not going to do things such as the Costa Concordia did or the Exxon Valdez did because they know they're going to get a call from the Coast Guard. Someone's now watching where before they weren't. Here's an example. The Park Service used to run around in little Boston whalers with radar guns to make sure vessels complying with the speed limit in Glacier Bay. They get an email if a vessel speeds in Glacier Bay now. We have no violations. We have to test to make sure it works.
Ed, I apologize again. We're now joined by Senator Bishop. Continue.
Sorry, Mr. Chairman.
So it's a way to compel compliance, ensure compliance, validate compliance, and be more efficient in providing services that ensure that we are protecting the environment and complying with the laws. As an example of validating the cruise ships are pumping in the right locations offshore. We can monitor where they went, whether it's the right location, whether they're discharging in the approved areas. This is monitoring the whole track line, which is provided to ADC, so they can compare the reports to where they said they were. This is an example of where We are actually involved in things I never expected to be involved in. This is with FAA and controlling traffic going to Kodiak Airport. It was a situation where a cruise ship was coming into the port. Cruise ships are higher than the flight path. The Coast Guard C-130 was flying in a reduced visibility and had to do an emergency pullout because all of a sudden he saw the stack of a cruise ship in front of him. And the FAA came to us with about a dozen people and said, what can you do to keep this from happening again? So we have alarms go off when a high-mass vessel comes in that particular area. Alarms go off, we contact the tower, we contact the pilots, and they coordinate so there's not a ship and a vessel, ironically, in the same airspace. I got the attention of Representative Feach, who obviously can appreciate that application.
It's scary when that happens.
Scary. Well, there should be no more supplies in Kodiak because we've basically fixed that problem after the fact, unfortunately. Shell wanted to ensure they didn't get in the doghouse. Unfortunately, found other ways of getting themselves in front page news. But had set up watchdogs and alarms and buffer systems so these off-limit areas, alarms went off in our operations center. We contacted the vessel. We contacted Shell to ensure they weren't in violation of these off-limit areas, and they had full compliance. There were no violations. We notified the vessels as we saw them going a trajectory that might lead them into that and made sure they didn't. They were aware of the restriction and stayed out of the area. And this is an example of one of the alarms that went off. Tor Vikings entered the buffer zone. We had a buffer before the zone.
Chair Wilson.
I'm sorry, Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In that previous slide there, now, Shell is doing that, but they came to you, and they're paying you money so that they are making sure that they're compliant.
Absolutely. They're one of our power users. They got a lot of accounts. And they have to pay for every single account. They have to pay for this monitoring service. They have to pay. So they pay as they go, but they help subsidize or pay for the cost of operating the system.
Wonderful. Yeah. Thank you.
So, absolutely. Yes, ma'am. Everyone who accesses it pays into it. User pays is kind of our model. As an example, an email gets sent off to alert, and our people then start making the notifications. We watch a Noble Discoverer as it departed. We watched that as it sailed through the Aleutian Islands. We've been using this for search and rescue cases. For example, a state vessel, we put a vessel tracking system on a state vessel, which is really exempted from having one, but they put one on. And it was used. At one point, the Coast Guard got a call from a fishing vessel that was adrift, going to rocks in heavy weather. They saw the Kestrel on their AIS site and vectored the two of them together, and basically it was a save. It was pretty graphical when you look at the pictures, just a nick of time type of situation. So not only is the Coast Guard the closest vessel. In fact, in most cases, it's somebody else. And the Coast Guard has this ability to look and see who's out there and can render assistance in a timely manner.
Senator Dyson.
Yeah. Correct me if I get the story wrong, Ed, but it's been my privilege to watch all this develop over the last 16 years or something. But when the Shenandoah went up, it was lost power and was drifting out by Dutch. Ed put a receiver, I don't know what it was, a laptop perhaps, in front of the Coast Guard commander. And the Coast Guard commander knew that that boat was dragging his anchor before the skipper did. Is that right?
Yes, sir. The only incorrect part was that Bill actually did all that because he's a smart guy around there. But the rest is true. The Marine Exchange would be probably a better term to use. But yes, sir. Ironically, the vessel on scene thought everything was okay and called back the command center in Juneau and said, we're okay. Everything's stabilized. And the command center here, which is 1,000-plus miles away, said, the Seldanger U is dragging anchor. And he's going, wait a minute, you're in Juneau. How do you know that? He said, well, I'm looking at this marine exchange system here. And sure enough, the captain of the ship said, you're right. It is dragging anchor. We've got a problem here. So it is amazing technology, and it's new technology, which is kind of neat. Here's an example of the Golden Seasons, which was a vessel we saw that was drifting backwards, was broken down. And that was used by ADC and the Coast Guard tugs and other people to affect a response and stabilize the situation, prevent a grounding. Here's an example of a vessel did run aground, and the detail that we have as far as when it actually hit, when it ran aground, and how fast it was going, and we could actually tell the Coast Guards on the NTSB and the Coast Guard were on the international news, talking about hitting a submerged object. We said, no, we can tell you exactly where it happened, when it happened, and it's not a submerged object. It's an island with a Coast Guard aid of navigation on it. So make sure that light is working properly, and then you're okay. And the ship said, well, yeah, we called you after you ran aground, actually. So, but the Coast Guard looked at the screen, and they blew it out. Now, this is focusing. They zoomed out, and they said, what's the closest vessel to render assistance? And they contacted the ferry, the Columbia, I think it was, good time. And the ferry vectored over and provided assistance in that event. So, and of course, the Coast Guard went on scene, too. The Kulik, we all know about the Kulik incident. I happened to be down in South America with my iPad watching that myself on the beach somewhere. But more importantly, people who could do something more effectively were involved, engaged, and participating in that. We had some limited coverage, as a matter of fact. As they got closer shore, we had some shadow areas. So one of our very adventurous field representatives, and they're all adventurous. These people previously climbed mountains like Kilimanjaro and Aconcagua. That's how you get someone for the Marine Exchange. Find someone who's pretty adventurous and then teach them the technology after the fact. You can't teach them adventure, but you can teach them technology. He even backpacks his client up the Old Harbor and set up an AIS site, and he did. He went up there and set up an AIS site in short order, and we could see the whole situation unfolding. So, and these people go all through the Aleutians, and it's pretty exciting things. We're also monitoring and managing risk. We're looking at things that are potentially high-risk events. Here's a high-risk event that recently happened, a container ship that was disabled in Unimac Pass, that we were able to see this, talk to Coast Guard and other players and tugs to be involved in that response. We have alarms go off and vessels come too close to shore. This is an example of a tanker that's not compliant with OPA 90, that's taken a high-risk route, which is not allowed for, cutting through the Middle Aleutian Islands. We contacted the Coast Guard and said, we don't think this is a good thing. They contacted the ship, and the Marine Exchange redirected that tanker. So it went away. And this another tanker did the same thing, went the other direction. So we're helping ensure and validate compliance and minimize high-risk events by monitoring. Similarly, we're watching others snoop around our waters, so to speak, this icebreaker Z-Long or what have you that's operating on waters. This is the examples that we use, and I'm testifying in Congress tomorrow, of the importance of having presence of the Coast Guard in the Arctic and to monitor our waters and have a presence and exercise our authority over our domain. Here's an example, much like one of our previous governors that could look into Russia from the backyard. We can actually look from our office into Russian waters, and this is some vessels operating in Russian waters here out of Bering Strait. So again, if we can't get on Russian land, we'll just point our antennas towards Russia and we'll look in their waters. And that's exactly what we do. This again is looking at vessels going through the Bering Strait region. This is the name of vessels, type of vessels. So when we talk about the detail, we have tremendous detail. It's not just lines. It's a considerable amount of data that we can generate and categorize.
Representative Isaacson.
Could you tell us again, what's the range on your radars on these monitoring devices? They're obviously over the horizon or something.
Yes, sir. It's over the horizon. It's data burst comms, so they travel much further than conventional analog comms. Generally, we say we can pretty comfortably say we'll get 100 miles, but depending if we're on Adak Mountain, which we are, or Nikolsky in the mountaintop, we're looking a couple of hundred miles offshore. So it depends on near-field interference, how high we are, what kind of antennas we use, and some just plain atmospherics. Arctic is a really hard place to have long range because the atmospherics are very poor up there. A lot of EM, electronic magnetic interference and what have you. So it varies. But generally 100 miles is a safe number, but we do better than that.
Size of the sea then also affect that or what?
To some extent. I mean, you know, fronts and, what do you call it? Thermoclines and whatever, other things all have effect on it. We also access satellite AIS information. It generally it's about 12 hours old, could be 4 hours old. It's sporadic. It doesn't get all the vessels, but it's another piece of information we use on a strategic context. And we have satellite tracking transponders on vessels that we use for tracking barges in this particular case, or in some cases Coast Guard vessels and fishing vessels and what have you. So we have a suite of options that we use to track vessels. This is an example of how one of our shipping companies uses it, so customers can go on and see where the status of the barge is. They just show where their barges are. We're also developing an emergency response database, so when an emergency does happen, you push the emergency button, you determine what you want, oil spill response vessel, towing vessel, what have you, and only those vessels show up on the screen, information on the vessel, and the location of it. Similarly, if you have an oil spill or a towing vessel, same idea, you push the buttons. This is shared by the Coast Guard in the state, with the Coast Guard in the state, to have this information. Where the ships, everyone comes to ask, where are the ships in the Arctic? They come to us. I get calls from Washington all the time, and for Army Corps of Engineers and the Coast Guard. So this is how we provide information on that. This we can show the traffic density and where the paths are and where they basically we should focus your effort on if you can do a risk assessment and manage traffic. Again, this is Arctic traffic last summer and seeing where they go, what have you. I mentioned before hot spots, Dixon Entrance. There's a lot of talk about the shipping and Dixon Entrance increased dramatically because of Prince Rupert activity. So we have focused and put more antennas down there to ensure we have complete coverage. And this is going this summer to upgrade our system, and the right-hand slide to show how we've been able to improve the range of the system in light of the fact that more activity is going on down there. I-5, I talked about that. And the shipping, again, we're focused on that and paying close attention to that activity level. When you talk about National Academy of Sciences and other reports been done, they've all talked about AIS being the tool to minimize risk in Aleutian Islands. And therefore, this is actually Bill Benning up on ADAC with the ATV built on top of the mountain, that old White Owl site, and building a site up there. Here's my staff working on another site in Nikolsky, which is a blank spot for us. We want to be able to see how Solidanging U happened by AIS and not just by satellites. So we built a system up there, went on a mountaintop, and built a system that's closing the gaps in our coverage. So we're continually upgrading and building the system. We're not done yet. We have several hundred thousand miles of coverage right now, but unfortunately we picked the wrong state. I should have picked Rhode Island or something. Bering Strait, obviously, as I discussed beforehand, going to different communities, going to schools, and clinics, what have you, to build, to tap into infrastructure to help support our systems. In Barrow, similarly, we put a system on the shell vessels, help extend our range, and also work with the University of Alaska Fairbanks to remote power module. Cook Inlet is always a hot area, and we've had very good coverage of that. We've been using a lot of risk assessments, and it's proven to be a good tool in there. We're now adding weather stations so we can disseminate ice information and weather information to vessels over IIS, broader range, better clarity, not have to listen to a broadcast, but actually see it digitally. So another application of AIS. The state benefits, the Marine Highway System looks at it all the time. Department of Military Veterans Affairs for emergency and response and Homeland Security, Fish and Game, Fish and Fleet, impacts of the cruise ships, what have you, public safety, tracking law enforcement vessels and other vessels, commerce, pilotage program oversight, environmental conservation with our power users, cruise ship monitoring, environmental regulations, shellfish farming. It used to be that the shellfish fishermen had to have an ADC employee on board to make sure they went to the right area to get the fish, and many times, or the shellfish, and many times DC person could be made available, so they didn't go. We're now using transponders to validate where they're going. Don't have to have the person on board anymore. Just have a transponder. It shows they're going to the right area, and they can do that. Yes, sir.
Why can't we automate the observer program that everybody's in?
Well, that sounds like Representative Young just talked about that. There are many things we can automate, cruise ship overboard discharge, server program. It's just a matter of willingness to do it. But there are many more applications. We're scratching the surface at the moment. But that will happen over time. It's inevitable. There are better and smarter ways to do this with this new technology. It just takes people a little while for people to actually buy into that and accept it. But we're moving there. Lastly, Department of Natural Resources, drilling operations, state boating safety, what have you. Our future plans are expand and improve the network to fill gaps, add weather environmental sensors, disseminate safety information via AIS, search and rescue receivers I've talked about beforehand, and then lastly is just really kind of institutionalize the Marine Exchange building. And I'll talk about that for a second. This is our latest project of building weather sensors with our AIS sensors to co-locate, to get more return on investment. Filling those gaps where there are no sensors right now, we're putting new sensors. So we're partnering. We've got an MOU with the National Weather Service that we're working on, and Alaska Ocean Observing System is supporting us also. So we're building on and getting more and more mileage out of these sites that we're building throughout Alaska. Here's an example of our network down in Southeast. Here's a website that shows our new sensors we put on, but they're also being disseminated other means. But this is our sensor information around Alaska. I talked about the search and rescue capability. I'm talking to Alaskan whalers as we speak, trying to provide them information and data and sensors and tracking capabilities. So we're sending information up there, equipment up there, so that the big ships can see the whaling boats, they can see where the other boats are, and minimize the potential for whaling boats, subsistence vessel be run over by offshore supply vessel, other vessel transiteers. So we've got a pilot program going on as we speak. and the stuff will be going out the door the next week or so, and our people will be flying up there also to place like Savunga, Gamble, and Point Lake. If you look at the bottom of the screen, these are all inputs, satellite AIS, terrestrial AIS, environmental sensors, search and rescue alerts, vessel monitoring systems, all that comes into our network and disseminated. State, the Coast Guard, owner-operators, oil spill response organization, agents, pilots, what have you. Everyone who's involved in the system ends up contributing to supporting the system. That's how we're able to amortize the cost of any one party. Governor Parnell's been here several times, a big fan of ours. The Commandant of the Coast Guard, Admiral Papp, came here and visited, said that the only way we're going to be able to survive in this budget environment is these type of partnerships. So he's been appreciative. We've received the Meritorious Public Service Award from the Coast Guard for innovative efforts towards enhancing maritime safety and leading-edge technology, critical maritime information for both government and commercial users of unprecedented levels of some of the discussion that they had there. This is where we are right now on downtown Juneau. This is our second move. We're briefly above the Hangar Restaurant, which got a little bit distracting. But my point is, this is a server room that is tied into the Coast Guard headquarters and to the district and to Lloyd's of London and all the mini exchanges around the country. It's basically patched together. We have holes in one to provide ventilation. We have fire sprinklers that should never, hopefully never go off. Otherwise, I quit because I can't even think of how I deal with that problem. We do, of course, have off-site service in several locations in the lower 48, but we're clearly the nerve center, and we're hoping to upgrade. And this is one of our hopes, and Senator Eakin's been supportive of this, and as well as the community of Juneau, of providing us a plot. They're going to provide us the land by the bridge. It used to be an industrial works public works building. We want to have a building that provides an Alaska Maritime Center, which would be the term of it, that all the data that supports all of Alaska from the North Slope out to Aleutians to Southeast is in a safe building that's appropriate for the type of technology we're using, is professional, but also has an Alaska Maritime exhibit that we could show people the nature of the trade and the professions that are available to Alaskans on the ground floor. The Port of Juneau would like to be the tenant of the second floor, and the Marine Exchange would be on the third floor. I've socialized this with both the mayors and the assembly and some members of the legislature, the Rasmussen Foundation, and we're looking at the total cost of a 10,000 square foot being somewhere in the neighborhood of $5 million. We're prepared to do that through a combination of local support, which is providing us the land, hopefully some state funding, Marine Industry funding, Rasmussen Foundation, and Marine Exchange loan. Those five pieces could put this all together. And that would be appropriate, I think, facility to accommodate what we've got right now, which has very significant implications on Alaska. Real quickly, this kind of summarizes that brief. I'm going to have Bill, who's really the brains of the outfit. I just come up with these ideas, but I got smarter people know how to implement them. We'll go ahead and just show it as we speak at the moment. Bill, would you take that for a second? Just show them a couple of screenshots. This is a live feed of the ferry Kennecott. You can get the information bar, I suppose, and make sure that's the case. There's the Kennecott. There's the information on the side. It talks about course speed, destination, draft, location, what have you, on that vessel over the last 24 hours. But we can also jump to other areas throughout the state. But we can do a search function and find a vessel, or we can just look at all the vessels, or we can look at certain classes of vessels. Say we just want to look at tugs right now, or ferries, or cruise ships, or what have you. Can you jump to maybe Dutch Harbor or something, perhaps? Or, and there's some traffic, of course, in Aleutian Islands. And that, of course, is a live feed. You pick one in Unimac Passage, pick one of those vessels, if you would. There you go. This is a Hanjin Oslo, which is a large container ship, about 900 feet long, I suspect, 280 meters, that's sailing probably about 25 knots or so through the Unimac Pass on to the Far East. And this is another large cargo ship, RI-5, as I like to refer to it as. Appreciate your indulgence. And appreciate your support up to the state, for that matter, and hope to continue to support over the years.
Mr. President, do you have anything you want to offer up, sir?
Yeah, let me just say one thing.
Just hang on, Paul. Question from Madam Chair.
Well, it's not a question, but I do want to... everybody that hasn't been over there to see it. I've been there to see it, and it is fascinating. And it is so interesting that you just want to spend the whole day. But I just encourage everyone here that it's just right down the road, just a little ways. And so I think everyone should go and visit so that you really know what the capabilities are and how it looks and that they do need some extra help down there and with some projects, I think, that would help out. But please take time to go look because it's just wonderful, fascinating, and worth your while.
And before Paul speak, I just echo what Madam Chair said. It's incredible. In fact, I've been there three or four times, and one of the times I was there, it was the Gulf oil spill. And it was like, and we're tracking all these oil spill response vessels. I mean, it was incredible. And I just really congratulate you folks on what you've done.
Thank you, sir.
And seriously, Ed has offered to give members of our committees tours. Just let our staff know, Dana or Becky, and we'll set them up and
we're up 7 days a week, 24 hours.
They're 24/7. it is an incredible thing that's going on out of the top of an electronics store. So, anyway, I'm sorry, Paul. Go ahead.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Paul Foose, and I'm the president of the board. And just on behalf of the board, I want to thank the legislature for all the support that we've gotten over the years. We couldn't have done it without that. Started out with Senator Drew Pierce. We used Exxon Valdez oil spill criminal money to set up the first GIS system to display it. But ever since we built the system, as Ed has explained, our board is pretty diverse, and we do have a couple ports on it. But other than that, it's primarily a private sector board. And that's because the industry wants to have safe operations. They don't want the marine industry to be heard of only when you've got an accident on the front page of the paper. We want to avoid it. We do have an accident. We want the most responsible response. We want to know where the people are to help. The Coast Guard might not be anywhere near. It might be another one of the commercial vessel, might be the closer vessel that can respond. So now the other thing that Ed pointed out is that we protect these fiber optic cables throughout the state. That's the lifeline of the communications for the state of Alaska. Every time you access your computer and do a Google search or something else, Marine Exchange is watching over that cable. And if they get a break, we can tell them exactly where to go to repair it. They don't have to pull up 2,000 miles of cable. So, and you know, we're also running the system for the entire United States. That's why the one biggest concern the board has is the building that we're in. It's an old building. It sits on pilings. We've seen people camping underneath there. We're sitting on top of an old electronics store. Wiring isn't to code and things like that. If we ever had a fire or something like that, it'd be a real problem. So the city of Juneau has reached forward and said, we'll give you some land, and we're looking for some help to put together a decent building. We don't need a palace. We need someplace safe to operate from. So the other thing about our funding is Ed pointed out, and I think for the years that we've been in the system for a while, of how we argued about how cruise ship head tax monies could be used, and they have to be used specifically for the benefit of the passengers that paid it, except for Section B, which Ed read you, which says if you are contributing to the safety and efficiency of the system overall, you also qualify for the use of those funds. So when you see this fund source for our appropriation, the $600,000 or anything else for the Marine Exchange, it's coming from that cruise ship head tax fund, and other than the money that's being given to the port or was dispensed previously, I think we're the only ones that really qualify for that. So we hope to be able to continue to use those funds that are kept in state hands. And again, the board asked me to really express their thanks to you for all your support over the years.
Great. Thank you very much, Mr. Foose. Questions for Mr. Page or anyone? Representative Lynn.
See Rusher from here?
We can, in fact, see Rusher from here.
Call it up right now.
Thanks, Representative. Captain Page, thank you very much for taking the time to make a presentation and enjoy the red eye back to D.C. tonight.
Thank you.
I hate that flight. Anyway, nothing. We will take a brief at ease.
Let the record show that the House Transportation meeting started at 2:10 on March 26th, and that the following House members were present. Representative Christ Tompkins, Representative Gaddis, Representative Isaacson, and myself, Representative Wilson. And I'd like to recognize our staff today. Nancy Hemingway is over here. She's our House Recording Secretary. And Danaya Burns is our LIO monitor over here. And my committee aide is Becky Rooney. So before we start, please silence your phones. And today we have two bills on our agenda. Hopefully we'll be able to get to both of them. And we have House Bill 176, Experimental Vehicle Plates, and H.J.R. 13, Homeport New Coast Guard Cutter in the State. So if you can come forward with your, for House Bill 176, and Representative Thompson, and his committee aide, or maybe Chief of Staff, Dane Pearson, and introduce your bill and explain the changes to the CS. And would you move our CS?
I'm going to explain the bill first and let you do that.
Yes. Madam Chair, I move CS for Bill 176. I guess it's no longer version U. Version U.
Okay. Hearing no objection, we have version U before us. And if you can, you know, I don't think you really need to tell us the differences so much because we haven't had the bill in the committee before. And so if you can just tell us what the U version is, and we'll proceed from there.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Steve Thompson. I'm the representative from House District 3. And I will just go into the HB 176, make a short presentation, and then let my staff take over and explain it in depth and with the CS also. House Bill 176 is something that's, I feel, very badly needed in the state. Back when I was mayor about 10 years ago, we were trying to get a test track up in Fairbanks for testing, winter testing of car manufacturers of vehicles. During that period of time, I found out how many there were. There were just literally lots and lots of worldwide car manufacturers that were using the interior for cold weather testing. They would come to Fairbanks. Nobody knew they were there. They'd have their cars disguised, and they would do their winter testing and then move on. It was a pretty good size. It is a pretty good size industry. Just over this last weekend, I was home, and I had three people came to me and said that they test drive every winter for different manufacturers. And it's surprising how many people do. It was brought to our attention a little earlier this year that the Volkswagen of America had brought up some test vehicles last winter. They had done their testing, and then come to find out there were some changes in emission regulations, and they needed to come back a second year. They came back, and the Department of Motor Vehicles told them that they would have to have those vehicles titled and licensed for them to utilize them up here again, because there was no statutes that allowed for any of temporary licenses for test vehicles. So this bill basically goes into straightening out the statutes where that they can get license plates that up to 36 total months over 12-month renewals. And this would allow that winter testing program's ability to go forward. And I think it's very important to the state of Alaska to have this economic development driver that utilizes a lot of mechanics garages, warehouses, and drivers. And so it's pretty good bill that straightens out some problems that we have. And I have to get up to finance, or I apologize, but I'm going to turn this over to my Chief of Staff, Jane Pearson, who will more in-depth explain the bill and the CS and answer any questions. And I know that we have some people that are experts that are wanting to testify to this bill also. So thank you.
Okay, thank you, Representative Thompson. And you go on back up to finance. And I would like the record to show that Representative Lynn has joined us. And Mrs. Pearson, if you want, go ahead and go through the bill with us.
Okay. For the record, my name is Jane Pearson, Chief of Staff to Representative Steve Thompson. Basically, what this does is create a license plate for experimental cold weather testing vehicles that would be issued by DMV. It would be good for 12 months. It could be renewed two times for a total of 36 months. These vehicles have to be either by a manufacturer or distributor, so it could not be Joe Blow, who makes an experimental vehicle in his garage. Okay. DMV really didn't want that. And one of the deals is when these vehicles leave Alaska, they either leave for good or they are destroyed. So you do not have a bunch of untitled vehicles in Alaska. These vehicles can't be titled because they are experimental vehicles. They are not production vehicles, so it's quite different. So this just basically goes into the registration, 2810-181, the registration of unique and special vehicles and vehicles used for special purposes and special registration plates to create a plate that could be used for cold weather experimental vehicles. And it is a big, I think you'll hear from FEDCO that this is a pretty good economic driver in the interior. And that's about all I have. And if you have questions, I'm more than happy to answer them.
Okay, Representative Lynn.
Thank you. Thank you for bringing the bill forward. The cold weather testing, I certainly understand that. But is there not other testing that could be done in Alaska other than cold weather? Because cars are tested, vehicles are tested all over the world in every kind of climate. Is there no testing could be done in other rugged areas, perhaps, of Alaska?
Representative Lynn, through the chair, I did check with DMV, and there is currently no other testing going on in Alaska. However, if the committee thinks that this would be a good thing to do, we could speak with DMV. I believe Shelley Mellett is on the line. She is deputy director of DMV, and she could probably fill you in a little bit better on this. We have worked with DMV on this and with Volkswagen of America to make sure it would work for both of them.
A follow-up?
Follow-up, Representative Lee.
Yeah, I would think, you know, there's no other testing going on in Alaska now, but for economic development, maybe there should be, because we have a large state, all kinds of vehicles that can be tested up here, and I hate to close the door on something other than cold weather.
Representative Lynn, through the chair, I mean, the sponsor, I do not have a problem with that. I would prefer if we ran it by DMV and just make sure they don't have a problem with it.
Thank you. I'd like to pursue it later on.
Okay, thank you. Representative Isaacson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am supportive of this, definitely. I know how much it's important, but I'm also not wanting to leave money on the table, as it were. So let me ask you a couple questions with the chair's permission. We looked into this. Minnesota is the only other state that does cold weather vehicle testing, I guess, in International Falls. I guess they do that. And in Minnesota, they are charging $50 for the first four plates and $35 after that for each one. It expires every December 31st, and it does not prorate throughout the year and so forth. So I'm just curious, what does this do in a competitive position for us? How much does it cost the first year? What's the renewal? Where are we? Are we over-competitive, under-competitive? You know what I'm saying?
Representative Isaacson, through the chair, that's a great question to ask DMV. We have not had communications on what this would cost. They do other other specialty license plates, which I believe are around $35, but I'm not sure. So I think DMV is the people.
All right.
And Shelley Mellett is online. So Shelley, will us ask her those questions. Shelley, are you there?
Yes, this is Shelley.
Introduce yourself and your affiliation, and have you been listening?
Yes, Madam Chairman. This is Shelley Mellett, Deputy Director of Division of Motor Vehicles. Currently, the price would be $90 a year for registration fees for an experimental vehicle because they fall under commercial vehicle rates. And then I know that Representative Lynn asked about taking off the cold weather testing portion. We don't have a concern with that. We've been up to visit the facility recently in Fairbanks, and currently that's all they're doing up there. But we don't have an issue with taking cold weather off.
All right. Follow up with Representative Isaacson.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Millott, for your answer. Now, that's $90 a year per vehicle. Do we prorate that? Do we charge $90 each renewal, or is it $90 for 3 years?
Through the chair, Representative Isaacson, that's $90 for 12 months, every 12 months.
So we're a little more expensive than Minnesota might be, I take it. If I may, Madam Chair, Ms. Millott, do you set the fee structure, that is, DMV set the fee structure, or how would that be set?
The fee structure is set out by the legislature and statute. It's set out in 2810-421, and they would be considered a commercial vehicle.
So if we wanted to make a special category, such as Representative Lynn was suggesting, a vehicle testing category, we as the legislature could set that up inside of this bill, perhaps.
That's correct.
Thank you.
Shelley, this is Representative Wilson, and if we just took out the cold weather and just say the testing for the experimental vehicle testing, that would be enough for you to be able to be a little more flexible?
Yes, Madam Chair, that would be fine.
Okay, thank you. We have some more. Are there any other questions from the committee? Because we do have some people online that would like to make some comments. Okay, let's go to Virginia. Allison Earhart from Virginia, could you give your affiliation and your name and let us hear your testimony?
Sure. Thank you very much, Madam Chairman. My name is Allison Earhart. I am an attorney at Volkswagen Group of America, which is the kind of parent company of the Volkswagen operations in the United States. Excuse me. And, you know, we are very much in support of this bill. Basically, I'm an in-house attorney, and I specialize in licensing matters. I can attest that this bill would allow Volkswagen Group of America to continue to perform its cold weather testing in Alaska. Representative Steve Thompson did accurately state basically what had happened. Originally, Volkswagen Group of America would come in, test their vehicles, and apply for a one-year registration. However, with more stringent EPA standards, it kind of became necessary to bring the vehicles back in for subsequent years. And there wasn't really any provision available for us to do that. So that's kind of when we reached out and just started to explore what was going on.
Okay, thank you very much. Any questions?
Sure.
For Allison? Representative Isaacson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for your testimony. So as set up, this is fine. It doesn't need to be changed. Except for perhaps, as suggested by the chair, we remove the mention of cold weather and just make it for experimental vehicle testing, not worry about fees or anything else. This would be adequate to keep Volkswagen in business in Alaska?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you very much for your testimony, Allison. Let's go to Fairbanks, Jim Dodson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is Jim Dodson. I am president of Fairbanks Economic Development Corporation. Fairbanks Economic Development Corporation has been promoting cold weather testing in Alaska for more than 20 years. This is a growing industry, creating jobs and diversifying the economy of the interior and all Alaska. For a number of years, we've partnered with the city of Valdez and the community of Big Delta to attract the cold weather, automotive and aeromotive industry to Alaska to do their cold weather testing. Today, there are at least four car manufacturers cold weather testing in Fairbanks. We advertise Fairbanks as the most accessible, reliable, and affordable place in the nation to do cold weather testing. This industry creates more than 200 jobs annually in Fairbanks. It is a growing industry. It is an industry that, as a state, we've had to put no money into it to attract. We have the resources in the state to provide cold weather testing, and I urge your support of this legislation as it is rewritten.
Okay, thank you very much. Any questions for Jim? Seeing none, thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
We do have one. Representative Gaddis.
And it's, thank you. You indicated that Fairbanks is the least expensive place in the nation to do this testing. I was just trying to figure out how, I mean, I realize that it's the coldest and some other things, but how did we get to be the least expensive?
When you factor in the accessibility and the reliability of cold weather, if for example, somebody goes to Minnesota to cold weather test and they fail to produce cold weather, then they've lost the opportunity. That's where the affordability comes in. It's coupled with the reliability and the accessibility.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And I can remember, I lived in Tok for 4 years, and I can remember when we had the temperatures that went clear down to 78 below without a wind chill factor. So it does get pretty cold up there. So let the record show that Representative Feige has joined us. And let's go to Fairbanks another time. And Julie Emsley?
That's right, Emsley. Thank you. My name is Julie Emsley, and I also work at Fairbanks Economic Development, and I'm the cold weather testing project manager there. And I also, of course, wanted to voice my support for HB 176. It should come as no surprise to anyone that everyone around the world associates Alaska and especially the interior with cold weather, and we experience that consistent cold weather conditions that Jim was talking about that's difficult to find anywhere else in the world and sometimes often impossible. So when you combine that with our facilities and the vibrant service industry we have here, Alaska has become a prime location for companies to cold weather test their products. This brings significant impact, positive impact to our community and the Alaskan economy. In Fairbanks, it's estimated that that cold weather testing activities generate $500 million annually for the economy, the local economy. And the automotive testing industry in particular heavily utilizes Alaska in the interior for cold weather testing. So it was recently brought to our attention at FEDC that some of our local automotive testing companies are running into issues with Alaska's current vehicle titling and registration regulations. And as was kind of stated earlier, this was largely become an issue now because of changing federal regulations on emissions. And so our current regulations make it it's incompatible with what these car testing companies need to do the work that they're trying to do here. So I believe that HB 176 offers a solution to this problem we have, and it not only does it remove a barrier to the automotive testing industry here in Alaska, but I believe that it doesn't infringe on the DMV's ability to carry out their mission as well. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. I now am turning to the committee to see what your
question.
Representative.
For somebody, does any of the cold weather testing or other testing involve a change in the emission system? Where they might have different type of emission systems in the cold. Is there any provision for experimental type emission systems?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear that question. Would you mind repeating that?
Yes. This question went to you or to anybody else in the committee or here testifying locally. Does any cold weather testing involve alternative emission systems? I can see, I'm no engineer, but I can see where one emission system might be perform better in the cold than some other emission system. Is there any provision for alternative emission systems that might, if we didn't fix that, might run afoul of whatever emissions laws we have in Alaska? And I don't know what they are.
Do you know anything about that, Shelley?
Madam Chair, no, I'm not aware of exactly all the types of testing they're doing. They did mention to us when we were up there that Part of the reason they needed it longer than 12 months now was because of the requirements from EPA on the admission test, that they test them for longer periods of time.
Right. And I am a little bit familiar with that. And a lot of the gas, it has something to do with the gasoline and what kind of gasolines that we're using, and they're trying to make changes. Well, they have made changes all over, and we're actually trying to get some exemption for Alaska. So, but I can see where you would need to do that, and then come back if you have to make a change, to come back and recheck it. So, thank you very much, Ellie. Oh, we have a question from Representative Christ Tompkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is for one of the FEDC folks. I was wondering how Valdez figures into Fairbanks cold weather testing, what the partnership is. One of the FEDC people mentioned that Valdez is partnering with Fairbanks for cold weather testing. I was wondering what that partnership was.
I could speak to that. You know, we've partnered with City of Valdez in the past, partly because Valdez has the snow aspect of it that we don't necessarily have here. Valdez gets high volumes of snow, so as far as companies that are interested for that particular purpose, Valdez offers that. And so we've partnered with City of Valdez in the past to see if that might be a way, so when car companies come here to test, that they can get everything they needed within the state. And so they've attended trade shows with us, and they also serve as a place that we can refer companies to that are looking for just for that snow, really, is what their specialty is.
Okay, thank you, Shelley.
Good.
Follow-up, Representative?
I just wonder if there are other ways we can make our bad weather economical for the state of Alaska.
That would be nice, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to, if there's no other questions, I'm going to close public testimony. Oh, Representative Isaacson? No, okay. All right. Representative Isaacson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to make a conceptual amendment to remove the mention of cold weather on line 6, 7, and 11.
Okay. Not hearing any objection. Amendment number one.
Motion for discussion.
Sure. Okay, Representative Feige, you weren't here previously, but it was talked about before, and we checked with DMV here, and we checked with also with Shelley to see if that would make any difference, and Allison in Virginia, who is the attorney for Volkswagen Group of America. Mm-hmm. And they told us that it wouldn't make any difference if we took out the cold weather. So, I'm open for any other questions.
Remove my objection.
Okay. The objection has been removed. And so conceptual amendment number one has passed. All right. Any other discussion from the committee? And what are the wishes of the committee? Representative Isaacson.
Madam Chair, I move CS for House Bill number 176, version U, as amended from committee with individual recommendations and with 1-0 fiscal note. I think it's the 1-0 fiscal note.
Okay. Thank you. Hearing no objection, so moved. Congratulations, and you can tell your boss that it's on its way, what, to finance?
To finance.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
I'm going to get your green slip here.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, I need one, too.
All right. Now, we'll have a brief break while we sign the bill packet. Okay, we're back to order. And next, we'll bring up House Joint Resolution 13, Homeport New Coast Guard Cutters in State. So Representative Osterman is the sponsor of the bill, and he, I know, is up in finance right now. So Melanie Lesh from his office is going to come forward and introduce the bill. So Melanie, I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you, Chair Wilson and members of the House Transportation Committee. As you said, I apologize that Representative Osterman is not here to present the resolution, and it's a fairly short two-pager. My presentation is also short. House Joint Resolution 13 urges the U.S. Congress and the President to complete the funding and acquisition of 3 additional Coast Guard national security cutters and to homeport one of the cutters in Kodiak, Alaska. What the resolution aims to do is raise awareness that the Coast Guard is in the middle of the process of replacing 12 high-endurance cutters with 8 technologically advanced national security cutters, nicknamed NSC, and stressing the necessity of delivering all 8 vessels. We wish to highlight the importance of Alaska strategically in the region, focus on the importance of the increasing role in the Arctic, with more open water in the summer, resulting in increased maritime traffic. Kodiak is the nearest Coast Guard port and would be the base of operations for vessels such as the Bertoff. I might be mispronouncing that, but we have some Coast Guard members in the room who will probably help me. One of the 3 completed national security cutters which patrolled the Arctic this past summer in Operation Arctic Shield. The Coast Guard assists the Department of Defense's national defense efforts with its specialized capabilities in the region and elsewhere. Recently, at a national military conference, the 3 chiefs, the Commandant of the Coast Guard, Admiral Bob Papp, the Commandant of the Marine Corps, General James Amos, and Chief of Naval Operations, Admiral Jonathan Greenert, met to discuss maritime strategic issues. A main topic of discussion was the Commander-in-Chief's strategic guidance that in part requires that the U.S. military will of necessity rebalance towards the Asia-Pacific region. So HJR 13 is designed to send a reminder to Congress and the President to complete the program of record for the funding and acquisition of 3 additional NCS cutters. So that we can help the Coast Guard do what they do best. And we have 2 retired Coast Guard captains here to testify, and I'm available for any questions.
Okay, any questions for Melanie? All right, well then let's bring up our experts to testify. And Carl, can you come forward and state your name? I am sorry, but I'm not even going to try your last name. It begins with U, and then there's a C.
Yes, ma'am. Carl, you could tell.
You could tell.
And I am a retired Coast Guard captain who sailed in Alaskan waters and who served as a commanding officer of the icebreaker Polar Sea. And I command and wholly support this committee for taking action encouraging the federal government and the Department of Homeland Security to maintain a national security cutter presence in the state of Alaska. A national security cutter strategically homeported in Alaska would not only provide a multi-mission platform to serve the coastal communities in times of need, but perhaps more importantly, will build mission capacity for the Alaskan resident crew to better understand the unique challenges faced by mariners sailing in the Bering Sea and Gulf of Alaska. Thank you for hearing my testimony for House Joint Resolution 13 and for your support of the Coast Guard in Alaska.
Okay, thank you. And obviously we've opened public testimony. And Representative Isaacson, you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, 2.
Okay.
If I could. Is 3 enough and is 1 enough for Alaska? In light of what we just saw in the joint session.
Representative Isaacson, through the chair, I'm a retired Coast Guard captain, just like my colleague Ed Page, and so we're not really speaking on behalf of the Coast Guard needs. We have the privilege of being retired to speak frankly when asked to speak. When we're invited, we can provide our opinion of what's necessary. Of course, we always think we have the best interests of the Coast Guard, organization that we spent 3 decades each in. So sometimes I think we can come across as honest brokers, but of course, if to answer your question directly, certainly the 33,000 miles of coastline in Alaska, the number of ships that you would need to support that you would have in, down south, that's you'd need much more than three.
Follow up,
Representative Isaacson.
Thank you. I appreciate the judicious answer, Captain, and I appreciate the fact that you're retired, which, and I know that a resolution does not empower neither the state nor the feds with any demand. I mean, we're not saying do it. It's not an executive order. I just wanted to get that answer that you were saying. By far, this is way too small. If I could just, you mentioned in your testimony you're a retired icebreaker captain as well. Did I hear that right?
Representative Isaacson, through the chair, yes. I was sort of half my career on icebreakers, so I know we're talking about, the resolution has to do with national security cutters, so if this was a different venue, I'd be touting the needs of the nation, the needs of Alaska, to build and sustain a viable icebreaker fleet. That's
and
with this.
Madam Chair, if I could, if this was speaking about icebreakers and so forth, with your permission, could I just ask one question about an icebreaker?
Sure.
Is it feasible to support an icebreaker home port in Alaska, or is, in your estimation, is that something that we should just keep separate from all these other boats and let them stay down south?
Representative, through the chair, that's a very good question. You know, especially with the national security cutter, they're very high tech. They will have there'll be high demand technical support that's required shoreside to meet the requirements of that crew. Doesn't mean that capacity can't be built in a port like Kodiak. It probably doesn't exist right now to really maintain a national security cutter. Same could be said for an icebreaker, that really the amount of depot level support required to maintain high-tech vessels would be a capacity that would need to be developed.
So we could say build it and they will come?
Yes, ma'am.
So, Madam Chair, just to clarify one statement that he said about the cutters.
Representative Isaacson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So if I heard you, Captain, you said that even if we asked for a cutter to be here, we don't necessarily have the technical expertise at port at this moment?
Representative, through the chair, that would be my opinion as a retired old guy.
All right. I
appreciate that. I might give you a different answer, but it could be built, but it doesn't exist right now, in my opinion.
Hopefully, with this resolution, we would be encouraging, I guess, that build out as well. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you very much. Representative Feige has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In the supporting document, it says they're using this new class, this Legend class of vessel, to replace the high endurance cutters. What's currently based in Kodiak?
Through the chair, right now, the Coast Guard Cutter Monroe is a 378-foot high-endurance cutter. Okay. So these high-endurance cutters were built in the late 60s, early 70s. There was 12 of them. The Coast Guard is in the process of decommissioning those 12 to replace them with 8 of the national security cutters is the plan. Currently, only 5 have been funded. And part of this resolution is to provide encouragement to the federal government to build the remaining 3. And if I may, I'll also throw in that my son, also in the Coast Guard, is assigned to the Monroe in Kodiak right now.
Okay. Very good. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you very much. Oh, Representative Lynn has a question.
You may not be the person to ask, but I see down here on page 2, line 20, we're going to send the copies. Why do we not have the President of the United States and the Secretary of the Treasury?
Maybe the
Coast Guard's not in Treasury anymore.
Well, isn't it? What does the Coast Guard come under?
Representative Lynn, through the chair, it's the Department of Homeland Security is the department.
Did it used to be Treasury?
Mm-hmm. It was a Treasury, and then it was Transportation.
Okay.
And now DHS.
I apologize for my age.
Okay, thank you very much. And Ed Page, can you come forward?
Accumulated wisdom in history.
That's right.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Edward Page. I'm also retired Coast Guard captain and served
the Coast Guard for some 30 years. In fact, I was a Coast Guard cutter, high endurance cutter, the Boutwell that first brought me to Alaska back in 1973. Even then, we were in the Department of Transportation. I think it was 1968 we were in the Department of Treasury, as I recall.
Yeah,
so
19,
we are dating.
19,
sir.
Not 18. Okay. So,
in any case, I appreciate having been a retired Coast Guard. I'm out now for about 12 years. I've retired from the Coast Guard. But while I was in the Coast Guard, and I sort of had several assignments up here, up in Anchorage, Ketchikan, and Juneau, I've always enjoyed a very good relationship with the state of Alaska. And it's one of those areas where the Coast Guard truly feels appreciated by Alaskans. And, of course, that makes sense in light of the nature. It's a maritime state. There's no state more maritime than Alaska. So it's a very symbiotic, very good relationship that I've been very fortunate to be part of that. So I also applaud your efforts to encourage the presence of more Coast Guard cutters. And I'm coming from a little different perspective than Captain Ugutel, who's served as on cutters many years up here. I was more in the operation of support operation, or actually marine safety programs. So as a chief of marine safety at one point for the Pacific area, and then as chief of marine safety for Alaska, and involved decisions of allocating cutters and enforcement oversight and fisheries and what have you. Clearly, as my predecessor had been mentioned, the enormity of the state of Alaska makes the challenge even greater than it's ever been. And to exacerbate that problem, of course, is the fact that now it's getting even more water due to the climate change and the Arctic opening up and more traffic and more activity in offshore exploration. I was on some of those drilling platforms back in 1984 when they were initially doing exploratory drilling in the Chukchi Sea. Whole different environment today now. Things are finally starting to gel and starting to happen. And the Coast Guard presence, I think, is very important. Much akin to just having policemen on a highway. Not too many people obey the speed limit. It wasn't for the fact that somebody was out there and enforce it. And that's essentially what the Coast Guard does. So the fact, the presence and monitoring, and then when something does go wrong, much like our communities, if something goes wrong, the policeman will show up or the Coast Guard will show up and ensure that an effective response is executed to prevent a loss of life, property, and environmental harm. So as we open up more water, it's totally illogical to say that we have to have more cutters to cover more water. Right? That's one of the metrics they use when you determine where cutters go and how you allocate them. It's just how much water are we looking at and what are the issues and how important are they and what is the Coast Guard's role in doing that. And certainly as when we look at some of the vessels that are snooping around, if you will, or transiting and reconnoitering in Alaskan waters, looking at our resources right now as the United Nations Law of the Sea Convention is being deliberated as far as our role on it, clearly people, other nations, and China most remarkably, have a great interest in tapping the resources right along our shores or just offshores. So once again, I think that it's likely that, maybe I'm too presumptuous here, but it's good potential that the United Nations Law of the Sea will exist and will extend our borders even further because of that, because it'll be beyond 200 mile EEZ. And that's going to be another further increase of our jurisdictional areas that we exercise control and authority and our resource that we need to protect. And obviously, the Coast Guard is the right agency and the right entity and the right resources to carry that out. So I think you're right on with the bill that you're introducing, encouraging this. I support it. I think it's appropriate. I think it's needed. I think it's timely as we're building these things to figure where they go to start making these decisions. And clearly, we all know, and I know I'm preaching to people, have the same understanding of the impacts of Alaska on the rest of our nation. Clearly, the whole nation is paying close attention. These resources are used by our nation, make it less dependent on other nations. It has a national impact, national ramifications, fisheries, oil production, development, resource protection, all are national issues. So, and clearly people in Maine and Boston and New York all paying very close attention to what's happened in Alaska. They all have a stake in it in protecting our last frontier. The Coast Guard is best suited to ensure that's done. So those are my comments.
And I'm going to follow up with the questions that Representative Isaacson asked. That is... In your from the area of your being able to sit at a desk and see everything that's going on, how many ships do you think we really need?
Well, I think you could put too many. There's just not enough in the hopper to build. So when you look at the huge, as I mentioned some earlier in a previous hearing, obviously we're present at the I-5, where more and more ships are sailing through our waters as the passage is going to the Far East, and more vessels are going up to the Northern Sea Route, and in some cases even going Northwest Passage. It's a huge area. So, you know, say three, you're still going to be stretched for resource. You still can't be ubiquitous. You can't be there everywhere. These ships basically sit for maintenance and servicing 6 months a year, shipyards or work or rotation. So right there, if you have two, you really only have one ship in Alaska. So we just do the numbers, the math, and it's a simple math problem. Let's realize that that's a good presence, I think a good target, and realistic in light of our status of our nation and resources available and funding, what have you, our budget. But they will be gainfully employed. There's no question. If we had three, they'd be gainfully employed.
Okay. Now, another follow-up question that I want to ask is stationed at Kodiak.
Right.
That's a long ways up to the Bering Sea. And do we need in Alaska to develop another port closer up there so that we can have a presence better situated for anything, any impacts in the Arctic?
Well, I think that's a tough question. The real challenge when you're supporting vessels in the station is really have that capability. And that's why the Coast Guard likes to commingle vessels, to have the support and technical people that can provide the support needed to maintain a vessel. And so when you start stretching them at the end of the supply chain and you're spreading them out, then you're less effective in doing so. As a practical matter, the speed of these vessels, they are, you're basically 24 hours away. If you're in Kodiak, you're 24 hours away to even the Bering Straits, for that matter, because they cover 700-800 miles in a day, 900 miles a day. So there's a lot of ground they can cover, and that gets you all the way up to, it's almost a barrel.
I didn't realize they could move that fast.
They can.
Wow.
They can. They've got some nice big engines.
Okay. Any other questions? Representative Christ Tompkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As we're in the supporting materials, three are built, five are funded, eight are planned. Do you have any notion where National Security Cutters 4 and 5 are going to be homeported, or is there a possibility they might be in Kodiak?
Through the chair, I really have not been taking that close attention to it. I'm sure that they're going to try to accommodate all the maritime interests along our country. And so it's always been a challenge with Coast Guard, of course, allocating resources. Everyone wants a small boat station, an air station, their communities. Fortunately, we've been pretty effective in the past with our congressional delegation. I've been very influential in the Coast Guard and been quite responsive to the needs of Alaska. So. But I really don't. Unfortunately, I just haven't paid close. I got another job that I'm doing now that keeps me pretty busy.
Any other questions from the committee? Thank you very much, Ed. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, ma'am.
Is there anyone online or anything that might testify? Okay, I'm going to close public testimony. And Melanie, if you'd like to come forward again, is there any?
I'd just like at some point, I would like you to consider maybe broadening the copy to include the President and the Department of Homeland Security.
Okay.
Is that a conceptual amendment?
I'll make that amendment if it's appropriate this time.
I think we might as well go ahead and do it. Representative Lynn.
I would propose a conceptual amendment, page 2, line 20 through 23, where it would fit in to include the President of the United States and the Director of Homeland Security.
Okay. Hearing no objection, amendment number one has passed.
Thank you.
Conceptual amendment number one. Yep. All right. Any other discussion? Any comments? What's the will of the committee?
Madam Chair.
Representative Isaacson.
I move House Joint Resolution Number 13, Version A, from committee with the attached individual recommendations and zero fiscal note.
As amended.
As amended.
Thank you. Hearing no objection, so the bill has moved. So thank you for standing in for your boss. And since we moved both of these bills out of committee today, we will not have a committee hearing on Thursday.
Oh.
So we are adjourned.
Oh.